I'm Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. I've been a cop for 27 years. I like to say I got a backstage pass to life. Well, guess what? I got some tickets for you. So come on in, pull up a chair, turn up that volume, and let's go. Chasing Justice is on. Welcome to Chasing Justice. Lieutenant Joe Pangaro here. You know, I'm watching and seeing what's going on, and I see the crossroad clearer and clearer. You know, in one of my conversations with some of my friends or maybe some people in the neighborhood, we talk about the changes that are happening to our country. And a lot of people talk about these changes that are happening to our country. And it reminds me of, I guess maybe back in the day when Elvis came out and parents said, oh my God, music was never like this before. Now, there was some truth to that. Music never was like that before. But it wasn't the end of the world like people thought it would be. But it is interesting how the cultural changes that come to us from the artistic world often lead. And I guess that's where the saying, you know, does art mimic life or life mimic art comes from. So you look and you say, did the cultural change start to happen and then music and modern popular culture reflected it? And therefore, you know, then people started to accept it? Or is it a situation where, you know, these artists come up with things and then we see, you know, society follows behind? And when you look at our modern world and we see the breakdown of families, we see the breakdown of relationships, we see the confusion among many groups of people. We look for people who are trying to find acceptance in the world, and they're also trying to figure out who they are, and we have a much more tolerant society than we ever had before. It seems pretty clear that all of these changes can lead to good things or bad. All right, so without belaboring the point, let's talk about the coarsening of the culture. It's been a topic here on Chasing Justice many times, the coarsening of the culture, the rape culture that we see out there in the world. And this is an important point. If you don't have teenage daughters or young daughters, you'll understand this is a topic to them that is hugely important, the rape culture. So you say to yourself, where did all this come from? When did we lose our civility and move into this place? And I think, again, we have to look at the music. Now, I'm not saying that there's not different kinds of art. Art that I don't appreciate doesn't mean it's not art. Just maybe I don't have an appreciation for it. There's music that I like that a lot of people don't like. I love classical music. I think it's moving, stirring, powerful. It's wonderful. I don't listen to it 24 hours a day. I also like good old rock and roll. You know, I'm an Aerosmith, Led Zeppelin kind of guy. You put them on and you listen to the burning guitars, and I think it's really great. You know, a form of music that I was never really attracted to was the rap music. All right, some of it, I have to say, I like some of it. I like the beat. I like the sound. It sounds really cool. You know, it was a totally different style, you know, rhyming out these different things. But when I look at the messages that come out of some of this rap music and I see, you know, the misogyny that's in this music, you know, calling all these women, you know, the B word, and, you know, they're hoes and they're this and they're that, and, you know, kill the cops and shoot the cops and this. And we look at that kind of terminology and you say to yourself, does that have anything to do with the current culture? Has that coarsened the culture? Well, here we are. We find ourselves in a world where you can't say certain words because they're painful to people, because they reflect on a time that was not the best time in our nation. But yet, we hear those words in some of that music. We hear it used as a verb. We hear it used as an adjective. And in the meantime, you can't say it in polite society because it is painful to people, because it is reminiscent of hateful talk. But then it's used in the music. So it kind of creates this dual-edged sword where it's okay for one person to say it, and it's in music, but it's not good for someone else to say it. That creates confusion. That creates confusion in our culture. And then, you know, you hear about, you know, shoot the cops, kill the cops. Well, the statistics on who gets shot by the police are really very informative if you take the time to actually go and learn about it. Police officers do shoot and kill people. Usually, almost every single time, it's because the person has done something to have the police attention on them. So, and I'm saying that it happens in a negative way. If people rob a store, if people commit domestic violence, if people have weapons, if they're high on drugs, and the police end up involved with them, and then there's resistance when the police get there, that ends up in violence sometimes, and unfortunately, people get killed. Now, for those people that are listening and say, oh, you know, well, the cops do the wrong thing. Sometimes police officers who are human beings do the wrong thing. They don't do it out of hate. They don't sit around and have meetings in the beginning of the day and say, you know what, let's go after these guys because we don't like this group, or let's go after that. That's not what happens. The police go where they're called. So if there's a call and the police show up there and somebody is there acting violently, they got weapons, the police have to take action. And sometimes that action is to use deadly force. It's unfortunate, but it's true. But I'm getting off point. So the whole idea is that we see the culture is being coarsened, it's being lessened. When we hear the conversations in some of that music, some of the rap music that's talking about, you know, women being the B word and women being hoes and, you know, you should control and you should do this and you should do that to them. And then it happens out in the world. And then we have to say, gee, is there any connection? Just like the parents saw Elvis swinging his hips and said, that's the end of the world. The reality was that it either reflected the changing in culture or it was part of the change in culture. And I think in reality, it probably is both. So as I look and I see this coarsening of the culture, I have to wonder, you know, where are we going to go from here? You know, because that's always the next question. We can look at the past and we can learn from the past. And we can imagine what the future will be, but we have to look at here and now to kind of fix ourselves on a point, fix a point on the map of where we are. And then we can kind of gauge where are we going. Are we going to a better place or are we going to a worse place? Can you put the genie back in the bottle? All right, so some of these societal things that we have, can we go back? Are we going to go back to a more innocent time? Is that actually possible? I don't know that it is. I think what we consider to be an innocent time might actually be looked at 20 years from now as this is the innocent time. Think how scary that is. You know, we have cultural trends now. We've never been more divided than we are right now. We look at the world of left and right, and we've spoken about this before. But I look and I don't see that we're all going in the same direction. We're just paddling different boats. We're on completely different rivers, all right? That's really the problem. We have an entire portion of our country that, whether they understand it or not, are trying to move us away from our traditional roots of who America is and what we stand for, and move us to a place that many of us are not comfortable with. You know, when I talk to young people, and I've quoted these statistics before, I think they said like 56 to 60% of young people 18 and under think that socialism is a valid form of government that we need to try. Now, for those of us who are a little longer in the tooth, like myself, and we have seen what happens when socialism really takes hold, is that we don't see a rising of all the boats. We see all the boats lowered because the entire standard gets lowered, the standard of life, the standard of achievement, everything gets lowered and everyone becomes the same. Well, strike that. Not everyone. The people get lowered. Their lifestyle get lowered. Everything gets lowered for them. The leaders, almost in every example, their lifestyle gets better. They become the elite, the know-it-alls. They are the ones that control the levers of power, and they also control the rewards, and they control the punishments. And when you have an elite group of people controlling those things, the most of us, the majority of us out here, we're all going to get hurt by that. So if it doesn't matter what you do, you only get the same thing as the guy next door, then why would you do more? Now, to young people, I can imagine that this sounds reasonable because they look at it from a different perspective. They're not saying, if I do less, we all get the same. They're saying, hey, if we all had the same, wouldn't that be fair? I know, speaking to my own kids and kids that are, you know, in high school and young college people, because I'm out doing assessments and checking on safety and security in businesses and all these places, and I talk to people. I want to get a handle on what's going on so I can understand the threats that are out there. And the way these young people are seeing this is that the world is very unfair, and it's not unfair because of effort on the part of people who are trying to get things. It's unfair because not everyone has the same thing. And this whole concept of making sure that everything is fair, you know, ensuring a fair outcome becomes a very attractive thing to a lot of young people. They see this and go, hey, the government is powerful. And if the government is powerful and wants everyone to have everything they need, that must be a good thing. So if people need health care, if the government mandates that everybody get health care, wouldn't that be great? Well, I guess in a dream world, that would be possible. Because the reality is people still have to be paid. You have to pay doctors. You have to pay hospitals. You have to pay all the people in the healthcare business. They have to be compensated for their time, their effort, the amount of time they put into college, the learning. How about all the drug companies? I know, drug companies are horrible. But drug companies spend billions of dollars to come up with medications that will help us eradicate disease, help us overcome physical problems, ailments, mental ailments that we have. Now, it would be wonderful if they could find these pills and just give them away to people who needed them. I think that would be great. But the reality is, to get to that point, these companies have put out millions and millions of dollars. They've risked their companies sometimes to come up with these different medications, of which many of them fail along the way until they get one or two that are money makers. And at that point, they need to recoup their money that they put out. All right? They don't just make drugs because out of the goodness of their heart. It's a business. It's a business, first and foremost, and the goal of a business is to make money. Now, here's where we run into a problem, where sometimes these young people don't see this as being any kind of fair. If you have a company that can make a pill that could cure blindness, that company should give that away to people that can't afford it so they wouldn't be blind. Of course, who wouldn't say that? If I was a trillionaire, I would buy the drugs and give it to people. But the reality is, you can't just give it away. Now, the government can step in and say, if you want to get a patent or whatever to make that medicine after you spent all this money, then you'll have to give it at a reduced rate. That's government control on things. You know, young people see goodness of the heart, and that's what they look at, to make it fair. Wouldn't it be fair? It's not fair that someone doesn't get the medicine they need. And I understand that. It's heartbreaking. I've been blessed so far. I haven't been in that position. Specifically myself or my direct family, but I do know people who I was shocked to find out that they had to take a medicine that was like $1,500 a month, and the people that were taking, they were on a fixed income. They got very limited assistance from anyone to pay for this medication, and $1,500 a month can change a person's life. I know people at both ends of the spectrum, people at $1,500 a month would be more money than they could imagine, and other people that spend $1,500 a month on snacks. So there is a huge disparity. So when these young people look and they see socialism, they see the expressed goals of socialism, this utopian society that would be wonderful, everyone would be fair, but they see it would be wonderful and everyone would have the best of everything. If we look at Obama's promises that he made about Obamacare, it wasn't just that everyone would have access to healthcare now. You'd be able to get the healthcare you needed in an emergency. It was you were going to get better healthcare. You were going to get more healthcare. It was going to be utopian, and it was going to cost you less. I think the specific amount he kept citing was going to cost the average family $2,500 a year less to have this wonderful, tremendous healthcare that was going to be better, more prevalent, everywhere you could find it, and the quality would be so much better. The problem with that is that all of those things cost money, and if you lower the cost, you're going to get what you pay for. So we saw the only way to do that was to attack young, healthy people and force them to pay more. Well, these young people couldn't believe they had to pay so much money for healthcare. They don't need it. They didn't want to buy it, so the government instituted a penalty. If you don't buy healthcare, then you have to pay a fine because we need your money. This stuff has to be paid for by somebody. And I think younger people don't always understand that connection. I don't fault them for their desire to see the world as utopian and beautiful and wonderful and fair to everyone. The reality is that that's not always possible. So this is where I kind of see, where are we going next? You know, what is next on the agenda for America? If we're not going to go back in time, we can't put the genie back in the bottle. How do we see our way forward? What is the next set of good old days? Well, I'd have to say that whether you like him or you don't like him, President Trump has changed the economy. His policies, his belief are much more conservative. Whether he's a conservative or not, I don't know his heart. But the policies that he's espousing and pushing forward are very conservative in nature. And I think if we look very realistically, that conservative policies, whenever they are put into place, normally work, because they're based on sound principles, not on hopes and dreams. Now, there's nothing wrong with hopes and dreams. Hopes and dreams should be a part of all of our planning for the future. But we have to look at hard facts. And the things that Trump has put into place have been a boon to the economy. Look at the economy. I think the other day they said, I heard this statistic come out, that there are over 700,000 more jobs than there are Americans to take them. That means, technically, everybody who wants a job should be able to get a job. The other thing that's going to do is, because there's a lack of workers and a lack of skilled people to take these jobs, the wages are going to go up. It's a natural occurrence, because you have a limited number of people to fill other jobs. Well, how are you going to get the best people? You're going to have to offer them more so that they'll come to you. I know a couple of companies that I've been dealing with recently. This is a problem that they're having, to find the best quality people, because they'll get somebody to come in for an interview, and in the meantime, they might have a 2-week lag before they make a hiring decision. That person is snapped up by another company who stepped in and said, hey, you are quality, I'm going to give you more money, come here, and they go. So we're seeing some positive changes with a positive economy. So I'm looking at that and saying that's part of a more conservative and realistic way to go. If we were to continue those kind of policies, the country would probably improve dramatically over where we are now. We've just had 8 years of living the socialist dream as far as it was going to go at this point in time in America. And we saw what it did. It dragged us all down. It dragged our economy down. It put us at each other's throats. It revived the evil and the horror of racism. It revived all kinds of problems that we thought were long gone. You know, the unregulated immigration into the country has now brought with it gangs, and it's brought with this ideologies that want to hurt us. It's brought people coming into the country that have diseases that we fought off long time ago. Doesn't mean any of those people are bad. It just means it wasn't done properly to make sure we did the right things for our country. So that's my question here. Where are we going in the future? Will it be better? Will it be worse? I think the story is not yet told. But here on Chasing Justice, on the America Out Loud Radio Network, we're going to continue to pursue it. Give us a call. Drop me a line, jpangaro@americaoutloud.com. We'll be right back.
The goal is to deliver a message of truth, inspiration, and hope to the world, to unite people from all backgrounds and beliefs in an effort to advance humanity. News blogs, informative podcasts, and entertaining videos. It's AmericaOutLoud.com, where the conversation never ends. With 24/7 streaming on our free apps on both Android and Apple. Welcome to the new era in communications, America Out Loud Talk Radio.
All right, everybody. Welcome to round two of Chasing Justice. Here we are on the America Out Loud Radio Network, and we're back in the neighborhood, and we were just doing a little bit of warm-up there. Everybody's singing and clicking along. We have Jack Patterson here, our all-American man. We have our man of faith, Bill Dallas, here. Our contrarian, who is always here. I asked him to come. He said no, and then he showed up anyway. He's a contrarian. And we brought back Kathy. We had such a response from her appearance that we said, you know what? It's nice to have the ladies in the audience. So we asked her to come back. So here we are in the neighborhood, and today we're going to talk a little bit about some things that have been going on with the police. All right, we want to talk about the police, a couple of incidents that made national attention here in Jersey, which is sort of Jersey boys and girls. We'll talk about it. In Wildwood, New Jersey, Wildwood is a beach community in the southern part of New Jersey. It's south of Atlantic City, very popular with Pennsylvania, Philadelphia people, and people from Jersey also, I suppose, go down there. But there was a video of a police officer trying to give a ticket to a girl, I think she was 18 or 19 years old, for having open alcohol or alcohol on the beach. She did not respond appropriately. She wouldn't give her name. There's some controversy as to whether or not she kicked the officer, whether or not she pushed somebody, whether or not she did something else. And we have to see, you know, when the rest of the video comes out, what happened. But we're going to talk about that in the neighborhood today. It comes up in law enforcement all the time. Are you allowed to not pay attention to a lawful order? Or do you sit there and figure out, well, I think that's not a lawful order, so therefore I'm not going to pay attention to it. So the girl ended up getting arrested, physically arrested. She got dumped on the sand, and she was handcuffed, and it looks ugly. Arrests always look ugly when people do not do what they're supposed to do. So here's how it's supposed to go, people. Police officer walks up to you and says, Bill, what's your last name?
Dallas.
Thank you, sir. You're under arrest. Turn around and put your hands behind your back.
Done.
And then I handcuff you and I take you to the police station. You don't agree with being arrested, you go to court and you tell the judge you didn't agree. When it doesn't go that way, let's talk to Jim for a minute. Jim, what's your last name?
Why? What did I do?
Because I'm the police and I'm investigating an incident.
Well, what did I do? There has to be some kind of probable cause. You just can't stop me and make me feel uncomfortable for no reason.
No, you poor baby, you feel uncomfortable.
Make you uncomfortable.
And what, are you going to throw me on the ground now, stick your knee in my back? Is that what you're going
to
do?
That might happen to you with that kind of an attitude.
Well, I say, wait, I should have any attitude I want.
No, you shouldn't.
Who are you to measure my attitude?
When you walk up to a police officer walks up to you and asks you a question, and police officer says, I'm investigating something, it's not for you to decide whether it's appropriate investigation.
You're investigating something, sure. What are you investigating?
I'm investigating that you have alcohol and you're underage. I need to see your identification.
Well, wait a second. Where's the alcohol?
The alcohol's right there at your feet. Six bottles of beer.
How do you know that's mine?
Because you're here. You're in possession
that's
of it.
That's my aunt's.
Your aunt is not here. I'm just in possession of it.
That's why we're identifying.
You see what I'm talking about? Now, Jim, anybody out there want to think that Jim would get dumped on the sand? Probably tased. A little wood shampoo. Things could happen. But anyway, this happened to this girl, and we've all seen parts of that video. It looks ugly when people resist. Now, resistance, let's talk about that. Resist doesn't mean pulling a weapon, battling with the cop. Resistance means doing anything other than complying with the orders of the officer.
Anything.
Turn around, put your hands behind your back. When you push away, no, you walk away. That is resisting that arrest.
I didn't see that in that video. Turn around, put your hands behind your back.
He said he was going to arrest her and she started walking away.
I didn't see that. Please turn around, put your hands behind your back. We're now going to arrest
you. Before that got to that point.
I didn't see that.
Stop. You're not
listening. And put it in the sand.
Well, that's because that's what you want to see. She started walking away from the officer because she didn't want to have to deal with it.
That is correct.
When you're investigating something and I'm asking for ID, you don't just get to decide, I don't want to be a part of this, I'm going to leave. You don't get to do that.
Did the officer breathalyze her and it showed negative?
That's not what we do out on the street. That's not what happens in New Jersey.
Well, they did it.
They can do it if they have the equipment, but that's not required.
Case closed.
Possession, case closed. Jim, possession doesn't mean you've been drinking it. Possession means you have it. It's yours. If there was a 21-year-old there could say, that's my beer, that's all good. You stop a car. Six people are in that car and there's a bag of weed on the back floor. Nobody goes for it. Guess what? Everybody goes for it. That's called constructive possession. Everybody goes for that because it's in the car with you. Same thing with the beer. Her aunt was not at the blanket with her. Therefore, she was in possession of the beer. That's how it goes.
Really?
Is that how it works?
What if the aunt showed up and said, yeah, that's my beer?
That might have changed the situation.
Okay, but then the cop should have waited for the aunt to show up.
No, let's wait for 2 hours because you don't want to be arrested. Ridiculous. I want your name.
Give her the opportunity to get the hand on the
Jack,
phone.
Jack, where are we going with this here?
You know, I look at it as you have to comply. I don't agree with how some people are treated. I don't know if I agree with the situation in Wildwood. It's kind of hard to say without actually being there. I mean, the body cam supply only so much information. The rest of it has to be sorted out in a court of law. It's not for me. I often wonder, though, Joe, when somebody gets pulled over, and this has happened over the last number of years, they're in the car, they look out the window, maybe it's a detective that saw you doing something wrong. They walk up to the car to get out of an unmarked car. They're dressed in street clothes. and they want you to roll down your window and give them your license, registration, insurance card, and you're not comfortable with that because there it has been known that there's been officers who are not officers.
No, people pretending to be cops.
And for me to take my car, for instance, and drive to the nearest police station doing the speed limit, isn't it the same as that girl resisting? Couldn't you take your car and do what's called a pit maneuver and spin me out, stop forcibly stop me? Or is it okay for me to drive to the police station? And if that's so, why wasn't it okay for that girl to walk somewhere where she felt safer?
Okay, first of all, apples and oranges. You're talking about someone in plain clothes in an unmarked car stopping a car. You don't know who that is. That happened a while ago. In a lot of states, you have people that pretend to be cops, and they pull people over. We just saw a kid do this in New York the other day. 16-year-old kid stopped an elderly man and told him he was the police, started patting him down, and stole money out of the guy's pocket because the guy was complying. He was trying to do what he thought was right. With the car stops, that was happening to some women. Women were getting stopped by these strange dudes pretending to be cops. And the advice that came out at the time was, if you're uncomfortable with the stop, if it's an unmarked car, call 911 and drive to the nearest police station. Now, that came out to us in law enforcement, that this was happening, that if somebody drives away and they're not racing away from you, like you could tell that they were trying to get away from you because they got 20 bags of dope in a car, but a woman is just driving away from you because she's concerned and she goes to the police station. That's reasonable. How that's different is that you had a uniformed officer conducting an on-scene investigation and it involved you, and they want your name and your information. Now, that girl, if she gave the information, the cop probably would have just written her a ticket, taken her beer, and she could go to court and explain to the judge that it wasn't her beer. Now hang on one second.
What if the uniformed officer perceived that was resisting? Next thing you know, just as Jack indicated, they're hitting you in the back, they're crashing your car.
What if that's not going to happen? First of all, in New Jersey, we don't do the pit maneuver. That's more out west. We're very, very progressive here in New Jersey. We don't like to arrest people, and you know. But the point is that if you're driving away, if you're driving, we don't do that in New Jersey.
Well, but when you say we, that you're saying it's ubiquitous. It's 100%.
No.
There are certain police officers that will do that.
Jim, there's people that will get stopped for no reason and have
license plate lights.
And they'll pull a gun and shoot the cop in the face. So how do you determine, well, it was just a license plate violation, or a speeder will shoot a cop in the face? Seems a little overwhelming on both sides sometimes. Some cops do the wrong thing. It's a very small amount of cops that do it. But if you're driving away and you call 911 and you say, I don't know who's stopping me, I'm driving to the police station, they're going to get on the air and say, who's stopping this car? The woman doesn't know who it is, she's coming to the station. When you get there, doesn't mean the cop won't have an attitude or be upset. But I'm sure a supervisor would be involved in that and would say, why'd you come here? Because he doesn't have a uniform on, he's not in a marked car, and I was afraid.
And it was a dark road, and it's not, reasonable. Yeah. Right.
So, Kathy, we're glad you're here. As a woman, how would you feel about getting stopped by unmarked cars and people? What's that mean?
First of all, Jack, you are not getting pulled over by a cop and having to worry about your safety. So that's number one.
Not only is Jack a handsome man, he's a powerfully built man also.
You know what? I drive, and I guess if it was in a dark place and it seemed a little concerning, not on the parkway, not right out in front of a lighted area at stores, I would stop and deal with the cop that way.
Would but you I'm feel familiar vulnerable? With cops.
Of course I'd feel vulnerable, but I'd be more probably worried that I was speeding instead of that I was really
unsafe. Unless,
of
course, it's like Jim's scenario. You're doing absolutely nothing, and the big bad cops just want to mess with you. Right, Jim? Isn't that what happens?
Well, and I don't want to...
Jim Giordano.
...occupy the entire conversation, but my direct experience, I was going over a bridge. Yes, I was speeding. The police officer pulled behind me.
Mm-hmm.
And now we're in the middle of an intersection, a crowded intersection, cars, people walking around. Mm-hmm. Well, I decided that I wasn't going to pull over where he put the lights on.
Mm-hmm.
I was going to find a spot that was safe to pull over.
Mm-hmm.
And the police officer got upset with me.
And what did he do to you?
What did he do to
Jimmy? Oh, you should have seen him in the mirror. He was screaming at me. When I finally found the parking lot, I pulled into a parking lot.
Did you get arrested?
No.
Did he hit you?
No, he called me all kinds of names.
What kind of names would
he call you?
I mean, because so, I wasn't the most respectful either.
No way. Jim would not be respectful. So the point is that you made a decision not to comply with the officer, but you went to a safe place.
I was complying, but I was complying not totally on his terms because I didn't like
where he was. Now, I've had lots of people in the course of my career that you put the lights on. Number one, they're trying to figure out, is it me you want? And they keep going. Now they realize it is. Now they're going to pull. They drove you. Where are you going? You tell headquarters, hey, car's not stopping. Now all of a sudden they pull into the parking lot. Now they're pulling into the parking lot. I would ask them, why didn't you pull over where I told you? I didn't feel safe there. Okay. Well, now you're safe over here. Right. Obviously, you didn't get hit
in the head.
That's
exactly how.
You didn't get a wood shampoo. You didn't get dragged off to jail
for
no reason. So the cop did the right thing. And bing, 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 I was speeding. Let's play that part of the tape back. I was speeding. So they had a right to pull you over.
That's the thing.
Hey, Billy, we're getting away from what we originally started talking about. And that was, why did this woman resist? Mm-hmm. All right. Regardless of why she resisted, the fact that the cop punched her in the face, that is way beyond anything, any way that they should have handled it. Yes, take her arms, put them behind her back, handcuff her, do all that. But there is no reason whatsoever, unless she is being not just verbally abusive, but if she starts fighting, then you've got to you've got to protect yourself as well. But to punch a woman in the face,
come on, now
totally out of bounds.
Bill, it's the police said she grabbed the man in his privates, kicked him there, punched him there, something there. Well, that cop then turned around and punched him.
Not in the video.
Well, you know what? The video only came out, other people's video. It wasn't the cop's video. It was someone else's video.
We'll see that if it's on that cop's video.
I'm just saying that, you know, if there was physical violence towards the cop first, then the punch would be warranted. It's not like he's just walking down the beach saying, let me punch somebody
in the
face.
Let's analyze that punch a little bit. We saw the size of that cop, right? He's a young man. That girl, she was a frail, smaller female. Yep. Now, if you watch... If that cop wanted to hurt her and knock her out, don't you think he would have given her a full cold cock punched in the head and put her out, right? If you watch, it's actually a cocked hand and he pops her twice in the head. The reason that people do that, and I'm not saying that cop is right or wrong, I'm giving you some background on this. When people are physically resisting you, you're trying to put their hands behind their back, you're trying to control them, they're squirming around on the ground, you're not trying to hurt them. You're trying to get them to stop doing what they're doing. So sometimes giving them a punch lets them know you're going to lose this confrontation.
What's the crime here? What's the crime?
Resisting
all this?
Arrest. Well, you can't fight with a cop.
Because she was sitting on the beach soaking in the sun.
Oh, she was innocent. Oh, my God. So,
and she wasn't drunk. They he gave her, and it was on the video.
She could have been stoned. She could have been on opioids.
She was in possession
of
the
alcohol.
The whole thing comes down to...
She never have gotten to that point.
The whole thing comes down to, you do not resist a police officer under any circumstances.
You just have to resist them, though.
No, it doesn't matter. Even if the cop is wrong, you work it out afterwards. You just say, okay,
afterwards,
you know,
let me talk. when you resist, you get nowhere. When you comply to what the officer is saying, then you can say, okay, you're wrong, officer. You're wrong. But if you're going to resist the officer, he's going to take action.
Right. And let's talk about how that works. The police are allowed to use the next step of force beyond what you do. So if you talk, they're trying to arrest you and you pull away, they can grab you. If you swing, they can swing back.
Did that happen in this instance?
Well, we're hearing that this girl kicked at the officer. No, we know that she pushed
away
from
him. Video.
I know,
I
but
didn't
just,
say that.
Just the video
the
isn't
report,
the
Jim.
Video is not
report by cops protecting cops.
So do you think the cops are making it up?
I think, yeah, to protect themselves, they'll easily make up things. It's shown all the time.
It was a crowded beach. They would have hundreds of witnesses to dispute it.
I saw the video.
I know. The video was an incomplete video. It was edited.
That's a good point. Is there any witnesses that saw her?
Right. So
how about the people that were screaming that were not part of her group? Stop resisting. Stop trying to help her. They were screaming that to tell her, stop resisting the cops.
You're not going to get slapped if
you're
you
not going to win that confrontation. If you're a big guy like Jack, Jack's a large, powerful man. If he's fighting with a cop, he might start winning that confrontation. But then you hear sirens in the background. All right, and here comes the rest of the cops, and now you're going to lose. And if you're swinging, you're going to get hurt.
Was walking
you can't
away
resist the police.
was resisting here. She was walking away, mm-hmm. and she wouldn't give her name.
So how far should the cop let resisting. Her go? How far should he let her go?
Should not
run
have
down
done
the block
that.
And go home?
Okay, but does that warrant, next thing you know, have your head in the... I mean, at some point, when the resisting escalates, mm-hmm. yes, it could lead to the cop forcibly getting on the ground.
Yes,
and hand.
That's the next
I get step. It. It was nowhere near that situation.
Did she turn around and put her hands behind her back?
What? The cop didn't even ask her to put her hands up.
When she pushed and walked away, and he tried to grab a hold of her.
Wait, did the cop say, put your hands behind the back?
I didn't see that on the video. Well, it doesn't matter. When she's walking away, now he has a right to grab onto her, because she's leaving.
Oh,
she's trying to run
that's
away.
That's assault. Well, no, she just walked away.
That's not assault.
She just walked away.
You're an idiot.
Oh, my gosh.
You are just an idiot.
Let me just throw something out there to you and let you know. There are times when the police do overreact. There's no doubt about it. And that's the point I think Jim's bringing up. What is that line of overreacting? All right? The bottom line is, when the police tell you to do something, you do it. Anything that you do other than what they tell you to do at that point becomes resisting. And I can tell you, almost every single time, it is the fault of the person being arrested. Because they disagree with the charge. They don't think they should be arrested. They don't want to be arrested. It's scary. Maybe they got lots of warrants and they're going to run away. Maybe they got weapons or drugs on them and they want to get away from that officer. The police are supposed to take people into custody that break the law. We send them out there. We're the citizens. We have them out there to do that. When they say to you, stop, put your hands behind your back, you're under arrest, they grab onto you, and any resisting you do, the whole idea is to make sure nobody gets hurt. The easiest way to do that is to dump you on the ground so you can't run and kick, hold you, and suspend your arms and legs, and then get you handcuffed. If you're pulling your arm away, you're going to get your arm twisted, because that could be something you could reach for a weapon, you could punch, you can hit an officer. I've seen it happen 1,000 times. So here we are in the neighborhood, and I want to thank everybody for being here. You know, Kathy, it's nice to have you here and have a lady's point of view. Contrarian, thank you, Jim. You bring up some good points. I don't know what they are all the time, but they're good points. And he's really a good guy, so, you know, he does speed. He's already admitted to that. Jack, thank you. We're going to talk about our sponsors for a second. We have A-Plus Technology. They are a leader in security and safety equipment for visitor management, notification, cameras, you name it, they have it all. A-PlusTechnology.com. Our friends at MCON IT, I want to make sure I get it right this time, MCONIT.com, MCON IT. They are leaders in data recovery and helping you with your large systems. They're for big companies. Pangaro Training, jpangaro.com. That's me. Give me a call. I can help you with your threat assessments, and even if you just want to talk here in the neighborhood, maybe we'll put you on. And Blue Magazine, thebluemagazine.com. Thank you all very much for coming to the neighborhood, and we'll see you next time.
Think back to the last time you felt healthy and energized. The best times of our lives occur when we're at the peak of our health, sleeping better, full of energy and focus. We know that fades with age, and you might be feeling the effects of aging as low energy and poor sleep. But it doesn't have to be that way. There haven't been any nutrition systems designed to rejuvenate our bodies as we get older, until now. Healthy Cell Pro is the only multi-nutrient system that impacts the building block of your body, the cell. Created by anti-aging expert and Nobel Prize nominee, Dr. Vincent Giampapa, award-winning Healthy Cell Pro cuts through the complexity of nutrition supplements by simply giving you the purest ingredients, filling dietary gaps to nourish your cells and enhance your quality of life for optimal performance. Visit HealthyCell.com and use code OUTLOUD for an exclusive discount, or call 844-869-9958.
Welcome back to Chasing Justice here on the America Out Loud Radio Network, and I'm your host, Lieutenant Joe Pangaro. You know, I want to talk a little bit about some of the things that I do out in the real world, because I think they're important for everybody, and we've kind of mentioned them sometimes when I talk about my sponsors, as well as, you know, my company as being a sponsor of this radio show. I'm going to talk a little bit more in depth on some of the things that I offer so that you can look at your school districts, your business, and all that kind of stuff and see if it could be important to you. And I'll kind of explain what they are and why they have value. If I can be of any assistance, then you can reach out to me and I can certainly help you if I can. So this is really not about being a commercial for Joe Pangaro. It's more explaining what it is that I do. All right. So currently, I'm in the midst of some change here. Pangaro Training and Management was a company that I started in 2009. I started out teaching law enforcement officers two specific skills. I was still active duty at the time, and I was the training officer. So what I did is I taught crisis intervention, which is for law enforcement officers, how to deal with someone who's in crisis, someone who's suicidal, someone who's problematic, and see if you can help them through the crisis. That was the idea. That class took off right away. It was interesting. I use role players in the class. So I spend the first day teaching you all of the techniques of what a person in crisis may respond to. We talk about the psychology of what goes on for someone who's in crisis or suicidal. And then we talk about what to say. But more importantly, I try and teach everybody what not to say. Okay, that's also very important because you can set somebody off with what you say. Because as we always say here on Chasing Justice, words mean things. So when I look back at that, that was one of the first things that I had the privilege to go out and teach other police officers with, because I was blessed to be a FBI-trained hostage crisis negotiator, and I found myself out in some very serious situations, and using the techniques was helpful, resolved a lot of things. And then when I would go out as a supervisor and I'd see my cops stuck at these incidents and I heard what they were saying, sometimes I realized they didn't really have enough training, so that's why I created the program. The second thing I taught was a course I created called Hyperdrive Narcotics Investigation. This was basically how to run a drug case from beginning to end. This was designed for police departments that had maybe somebody was assigned to narcotics, maybe a couple of people, and they didn't have a really good idea of where to go. So basically, Hyperdrive is a four-day class that starts out with vetting an informant. How do you get an informant? So I use role players. I bring in actors. And we would talk about all the skills you need to vet an informant to make sure that you can use them, unlike what James Comey and the boys did there against our president. There are actually rules for using informants and for getting search warrants and wiretaps and all that kind of stuff. So I would teach them how to deal with these people. Then in the afternoon, guess what would happen? Surprise! An informant would show up and have to be interviewed by the officers in the class. So they would have to actually use what I taught them in the morning for the afternoon to see if they could figure that out. So that's Hyperdrive Narcotics Investigation. So we would go from vetting an informant, then we would talk about surveillance. How do you actually go find your targets, follow them around, photograph them, see where they're going, try and find the drug locations, et cetera, et cetera. The next day, guess what? There'd be people we'd have to go find and follow around. Day three, we talked about undercover buys. Now this was funny, because everybody thinks they can do undercover. You think it's not that hard. You know, maybe in high school you used to buy bags of weed, so now you're a cop and you're going to walk in and you're going to buy some drugs from somebody. It's not that easy. It's really not that easy. It's much more difficult than that. It puts pressure on you that you don't expect, so you have to kind of be prepared. So this part of the course would take the officers and put them into the situation with role players who were dynamite actors. Jefferson Shimayama Sanders is a fantastic actor. Mary Bonzik is a tremendous actress. She's fantastic. I'm trying to think of all the people we use. Ryan Ward, a tremendous young man. Chase Thibault, Mark Bonzik, fantastic. So anyway, this is my cadre of actors that I use, and they learned the roles very well. And what would happen is if you ask them the right questions, you do the right things, they would respond positively. But if you didn't, boy, they would amp it up. I can't forget Andrew Dars, because I know Andrew listens, so I want to make sure I remember Andrew. He is a tremendous actor, and he brings a lot to our program. So they all do. So this is what we would do. And then on day four, we would have to actually go serve a search warrant on the location and recover the drugs. So we use airsoft equipment, and we actually conduct drug raids. So those are the two courses that I started with. And it actually took off. There was a need for this, and lots of people came to my classes, and it was great. Well, over the course of time, I thought the best thing to do was to look around and see what else people needed help with that I could help them do. I was blessed to have great people mentor me when I first came on the job. People that were experienced in law enforcement. I wasn't. I was a kid. I grew up in a town where there was no crime. Maybe soap and windows, breaking mailboxes, that was it. And I ended up in a town where there was real crime. There was murders, there were shootings, there were robberies, there were sex assaults. It was the gambit. And it was surrounded by towns that had lots of other problems. And I was pushed into this, and I was blessed to have such tremendous men and women from various police agencies take me under their wing. And they didn't just tell me when I did a good job. Oh, that was really good, Joe. They told me when I screwed up. They told me when I did something that wasn't great so that I could learn from it. And I never forgot that. So part of the whole training thing was a way to say thank you and to close that circle. And I always felt that that was important. So I want to, you know, give a shout out to Jeffrey Layton, tremendous cop. Chuck Wankowski, my blood brother and partner. Kevin McDermott, fantastic. Ken Kennedy was a fantastic guy. And I've got Annie Samuels from Long Branch PD, absolutely tremendous. I could go on and on. The people are really tremendous. They were great in their careers. They served their communities very well. And they gave me a lot of great advice. So my training was to go back and help them. Over the course of time, we started to see these school shootings take place. And we realized that we needed to help our schools be prepared to deal with these kind of things. So we set up some programs. We went and got some training as best as we could. And we went out and worked with our school district. Now, I was lucky at the time that the school district where I worked was very open to doing this. And they let us do pretty much whatever we wanted to do. And I'm going to tell you, we did some extreme training. It's almost impossible to think of even back then what they let us do. But maybe because the stigma of the shooting wasn't as powerful as it is now. But here's what we did. We set up at our high school. And we said, we're going to pick a day and we're going to run a drill. What we're going to do is tell you that there's going to be an intruder in the school. And I want the school to practice their lockdown when they notice that there's an intruder in the building. So we took a detective, an undercover detective, plainclothes, and we inserted him into the school, believe it or not, with a shotgun. Now, of course, it was unloaded. But we inserted him into the school with a shotgun, and he racked that shotgun. That racking of a shotgun is the international, oh my God, sound. Anybody that hears a racking shotgun knows what that means, and they know it's time to move. So this detective would go into the school, rack the shotgun and scream, I'm looking for Mr. Scott, whatever, you know, the principal or somebody. And you would see these teachers run, lock down their buildings, close their doors. In a minute and a half, the entire building was locked solid. And then we would come in and we would send a team of police officers in. Now they had to go and find the bad guy and then confront the bad guy. So I found it to be a great way to train our students and our cops at the same time. I started using airsoft equipment because it's very functional and it's very inexpensive. I mean, you can do a lot of training in actual shooting scenarios using airsoft, as opposed to a lot of people use the simunition stuff, which is more expensive. It does have a place in training, but it's very expensive. So departments, they might give you, here's your 20 rounds for the day. Whereas opposed to airsoft, you could have 10,000 rounds for $15. And the guns are inexpensive as well, and they're very effective. So we would send the cops in to find the bad guy, and they would either convince him to drop his weapon or they would use deadly force and actually go through the training. When we got done, we did a briefing, and we had the teachers and students come into the auditorium, and some of the teachers were visibly shaken and scared. They were crying. Some of them had never seen a gun before in their life. Some of them had heard it. It was panicky to them. And we knew that that was going to be a potential reality. But I always believed from the beginning that to get over your fear of doing something, you have to have stress associated with it. So we would inoculate them to the fear by actually having them go through it in a safe scenario. No one was really going to get hurt. It just seemed very real and it was scary. And we listened to the teachers and the students and they expressed themselves and they expressed that fear and that concern. Well, a year goes by and we do our second drill. We never tell people when it's going to come. We just tell them the day. And then all of a sudden we sent an officer in, and again, we sent him in with a gun and he was screaming and hollering and everybody locked down very quickly this time. Afterwards, we got all the teachers together and the same teachers that were crying the year before, physically crying and visibly shaking and upset, said, you know what? I did it a lot better this year because I had been exposed to it. I kind of knew what a gun would look like. I knew what the sound would be like. And instead of panicking, my first reaction was to save myself and to save my students. That was the lesson, okay? A lot of places I go to, and this is where you want to check with your schools, a lot of places I go to, they call a lockdown drill just that. We're going to do a lockdown drill. Some people tell you the time. At 10 o'clock, we're going to do a lockdown drill. Or 5 minutes from now, we're going to do a lockdown drill. Well, while that does help you walk through the motions of a lockdown drill, it's really not preparing you to respond to violence and danger because there's no stress associated with it. If I tell a bunch of teachers that we're going to do a lockdown drill in 10 minutes, they're mentally prepared. They hear the lockdown, lockdown, lockdown drill, lockdown. Remember to close your doors and your windows. And then they finish what they're doing. They go around, they close the doors and windows, and they move the kids off to the side. And, oh, look, what a great drill we did. We're all prepared. That's not really of much value because there's no stress to what you're doing. So I always tell people you should not use the word drill. You should send a letter home at the beginning of the year to calm the parents down and the kids and say, from now on, we are going to do, when we do our practice lockdowns, and that's what they are, they're not drills, they're practice lockdowns, we are not going to call it a drill. We are going to say lockdown. We are going to inoculate ourselves to the fear of hearing that because this can come at any time and you have to be prepared to respond to real violence when it's scary, when it's stressful. Otherwise, you're not going to be able to do it. So what I found is that that was a great tool to use. And initially, people are afraid, but mostly it's the parents who are afraid. Because sometimes the kids, when you're used to hearing it's a lockdown drill, and then you hear lockdown, you think it's the real thing, and they panic. And what do? They get on their cell phones, they call mom and dad, and say, oh, the school's in lockdown, there's a shooter here. And then the parents come piling over to the school, and it's a big mess for everybody. Everybody's hysterical. So you tell them in advance, we're no longer going to say drill. We're going to say lockdown, and we're going to practice to survive a violent incident. That's the key, practicing to survive a violent incident. Same thing at a business. You know, a business, not a lot of times they'll hire me to come out and train their staff and they'll say, well, let's do a drill. We're going to meet 2 hours before start of business or 2 hours after the business closes. Because obviously that makes economical sense. You don't want to interrupt the business day. But the reality is when we run that drill, everybody knows it's not real. They all know we're just kind of practicing and going through it. For the first time or so, that's good. So everybody knows where they can go. They can practice locking down. They can do all of that. But there comes a point that if you want people to really survive a violent incident, you have to practice it with stress involved so you can overcome what that stress and fear does to you. You know, one of the things I see in lots of places, businesses and schools, that they have keys to the door, that when the lockdown comes, when the violence begins to happen, when it erupts in the building, teachers, people have to go into the hallway or open their doors so they can stick the key into the lock, turn the lock, and then close the door so that they're safe in the room. Well, experts in anything about violence and danger will tell you the very first thing you lose when there's a violent incident taking place is you lose the ability to use fine motor skills. And if you think you're going to stick a key in a door and unlock that or lock that door when there's violence going on, when somebody's standing in a hallway firing a gun, you're sadly mistaken. You're not going to be able to lock that door. It's just not going to happen. So what you're going to end up doing is getting frustrated, scared, close the door, leaving it unlocked, and you're hiding. Now you're open to danger. So locks that lock from the inside the room or pre-locked or other, I have lots and lots of options for people. So what I did is I created a program, a threat, vulnerability, and risk assessment. I was trained by Homeland Security, and I started doing these threat assessments as part of my job as a police officer. I would help businesses and our schools be prepared. I would look at their facility top to bottom. My job was not to find fault with the people in the building or for their policy or for anything they did. That's not the purpose of it. The purpose of a threat assessment is to go in and get a snapshot of your physical and mental security profile. If your building, your school was attacked today, where are your strengths and where are your weaknesses? I want to help you find a way to enhance your strengths and mitigate your weaknesses. That's the important part of a threat assessment. So a TVRA, as we call them, threat vulnerability risk assessment, if it's done properly, it will go in. I go in looking at a building saying, if I was going to attack this building, what would be my options? How would I get in? How would I defeat glass? How would I defeat alarms? How would I defeat people? Could I maneuver in the building? How could I prevent anyone from seeing me? How can I sneak in, etc.? And that's where I go. I drive up, as I'm driving up to the facility, I look at the surrounding area and tell you, Is there a place for people to escape? Do you have escape areas outside? Do you have rally points? Do you have functioning communications devices? Do you have visitor management systems? All of these things are vitally important if you're going to survive a violent incident. And what I do when I come out, I look at all these things and then I can make recommendations. Because I can tell you right now, there are thousands and thousands of companies out there that are trying to sell their equipment to schools and businesses everywhere. We have the best of this, and the reality, unless you're involved in this business, you don't know what really works and what doesn't, what's good and what's not. So part of what I am as a consultant to you is my concern is you, your staff, your students, your employees, and making sure you all survive these violent incidents. So I come in as your advocate, and I can explain to you the systems that I have found that actually work, the ones that I put in my schools when I was a security director. I made sure I vetted them out, and I only put in the things I knew that would really work and save people's lives. And that's what I do. So that's a little bit about, you keep hearing me mention this on Chasing Justice here in America Out Loud Radio Network. I keep talking about I do threat assessments and training, and those are the kind of things that I do. If you want to learn more, go to my website. It's J, my first letter of my name, the letter J, then my last name, Pangaro, PANGARO.com. You go there, you can see the programs I have for schools, businesses, and for law enforcement. The other thing you could do is you do a Google search on my name, Joseph Pangaro, and you will find some of the many, many articles I've written for the FBI magazine, for Blue Magazine, one of my sponsors, for New Jersey Cops. I've written for Parents Autism Magazine, for Kids on the Spectrum. How do we secure them in a school? So I'd really like to hear from you. You can reach me at jpangaro@americaoutloud.com. And you can go to my Facebook page, Chasing Justice, and we can have a conversation. So thank you very much for listening. I really appreciate the opportunity to speak to you every day and get out there in front of America and give you my opinion and try and help people and save them. So have a great day, and we'll see you in a little bit.